If that's the best you get from the Archbishop of Canterbury, I could do the job. He swears to uphold the king's authorities, his preeminences, his jurisdictions. He swears to uphold his heirs and lawful successors, and he thinks of the bastard child Richmond, and Mary, the talking shrimp, and the Duke of Norfolk showing off his thumbnail to the company.
"Well, that's done," says the Archbishop, "and our men to it, for what choice have we? Shall we have a glass of wine warmed? This cold gets into the bones."
Thomas More says, "Now you are a member of the council, I hope you will tell the king what he ought to do, not merely what he can do. If the lion knew his own strength, it would be hard to rule him."
Outside it is sleeting. Dark flakes fall into the waters of the Thames. England stretches away from him, low red sun on fields of snow. He thinks back to the day York Place was wrecked. He and George Cavendish stood by as the chests were opened and the cardinal's vestments taken out. The copes were sewn in gold and silver thread, with patterns of golden stars, with birds, fishes, hearts, lions, angels, flowers, and Catherine wheels. When they were repacked and nailed into their travelling chests, the king's men delved into the boxes that held the albs and cotters, each folded by an expert touch into fine pleats. Passed hand to hand, weightless as resting angels, they glowed softly in the light. "Loose one," the man said. "Let us see the quality of it." Fingers tugged at the linen bands. "Here, let me," George Cavendish said. Freed, the cloth drifted against the air, dazzling white, fine as a moth's wing. When the lids of the vestment chests were raised, there was the smell of cedar and spices, sombre, distant, desert dry. But the floating angels had been packed away in lavender. London rain washed against the glass, and the scent of summer flooded the dim afternoon. Part 4. Chapter 1. Arrange Your Face, 1531. Whether it is through pain or fear, or some defect of nature, whether because of the summer heat, or the sound of hunting horns winding into the distance, or the spinning of sparkling dust in empty rooms, or whether it is that the child has lost sleep, while from dawn onwards her father's decamping household was packed up around her, for whatever reason, she is shrunken into herself, and her eyes are the colour of ditch water. Once, as he is going through the preliminary Latin politenesses, he sees her grip tighten on the back of her mother's chair. "Madam, your daughter should sit." In case a contest of wills should ensue, he picks up a stool and places it with a decisive thud by Catherine's skirts. The Queen leans back, rigid inside her bone bodice, to whisper to her daughter. The ladies of Italy, seemingly carefree, wore constructions of iron beneath their silks. It took infinite patience, not just in negotiation, to get them out of their clothes. Mary drops her head to whisper back. She hints, in Castilian, that it is her woman's disorder. Two pairs of eyes rise to meet his. The girl's glance is almost unfocused. She sees him, he supposes, as a bulky mass of shadow in a space welling with distress. "Stand up straight," Catherine murmurs, "like a princess of England." Braced against the chair back, Mary takes a deep breath. She turns to him her plain, pinched face, hard as Norfolk's thumbnail. It is early afternoon, very hot. The sun casts against the wall, shifting squares of lilac and gold. The shrivelled fields of Windsor are laid out below them. The Thames shrinks from its banks. The Queen speaks in English.
"Do you know who this is? This is Master Cromwell, who now writes all the laws."
Caught awkwardly between languages, he says, "Madam, shall we go on in English or Latin?"
"Your cardinal would ask the same question. As if I were a stranger here. I will say to you, as I said to him, that I was first addressed as Princess of Wales when I was 3 years old. I was 16 when I came here to marry my Lord Arthur. I was a virgin and 17 when he died. I was 24 years old when I became Queen of England, and I will say, for the avoidance of doubt, that I am at present aged 46 and still Queen, and by now, I believe, a sort of Englishwoman. But I shall not repeat to you everything that I told the Cardinal. I imagine he left you notes of these things.
He feels he should bow. The Queen says,
since the year began, they have brought certain bills into Parliament. Until now, Master Cromwell's talent was for money-lending, but now he finds he has a talent for legislation, too. If you want a new law, just ask him. I hear that at night you take the drafts to your house in. Where is your house?
She makes it sound like your dog-hole. Mary says, these laws are written against the church. I wonder that our lords allow it.
You know, the Queen says, that the Cardinal of York was accused under the praemunire laws of usurping a Lord Father's jurisdiction as ruler of England. Now Master Cromwell and his friends find all the clergy complicit in that crime and ask them to pay a fine of more than £100,000.
Not a fine. We call it a benevolence.
I call it extortion.
She turns to her daughter.
If you ask why the church is not defended, I can only tell you that there are noblemen in this land.
Suffolk, she means, Norfolk.
Who have been heard to say they will pull the power of the church down, that never again will they suffer. They use the word a churchman to grow so great as our late legate. That we need no new Wolsey, I concur. With the attacks on the bishops, I do not concur. Wolsey was to me an enemy. That does not alter my feelings towards our Holy Mother, the Church.
He thinks, Wolsey was to me a father and a friend. That does not alter my feelings towards our Holy Mother, the Church.
You, and Speaker Audley, you put your heads together by candlelight.
The Queen mentioned the Speaker's name, as if she was saying your kitchen boy.
And when the morning comes, you induce the King to describe himself as head of the Church in England.
Whereas, the child says, the Pope is head of the Church everywhere, and from the throne of St. Peter flows the lawfulness of all government, from no other source.
Lady Mary, he says, will you not sit? He catches her just as she folds at the knees, and eases her down onto the stool. It is just the heat, he says, so she will not be ashamed. She turns up her eyes, shallow and grey, with a look of simple gratitude, and as soon as she is seated, the look is replaced by an expression as stony as the wall of a town under siege. You say induce, he tells Catherine, but your highness, above anyone, knows that the king cannot be led.
But he may be enticed.
She turns to Mary, whose arms have crept over her belly.
So your father, the king, is named head of the church, and to soothe the conscience of the bishops, they have caused this formula to be inserted. As far as the law of Christ allows.
What does that mean? Mary says.
It means nothing.
Your Highness, it means everything.
Yes. It is very clever.
I beg you, he says, to consider it in this way, that the king has merely defined a position previously held, one that ancient precedents
invented these last months,
show as his right. Under her clumsy gable hood, Mary's forehead is slick with sweat. She says,
what is defined can be redefined, yes?
Indeed, her mother says, and redefined in favour of the church. If only I fall in with their wishes and put myself out of the estate of queen and wife.
The princess is right, he thinks. There is room for negotiation. Nothing here is irrevocable.
No, you wait to see what I will bring to your treaty table.
Catherine holds out her hands, little, stubby, puffy hands, to show that they are empty.
Only Bishop Fisher defends me. Only he has been constant. Only he is able to tell the truth, which is that the House of Commons is full of heathens.
She sighs, her hands fall at her sides.
And now, under what persuasion has my husband ridden off without a farewell? He has not done so before. Never.
He means to hunt out of Chertsey for a few days.
With the woman, Mary says. The person.
Then he will ride by way of Guildford to visit Lord Sands. He wants to see his handsome new gallery at the Vine. His tone is easy, soothing, like the Cardinal's. Perhaps too much so. From there, depending on the weather and the game, he will go to William Pollett at Basing.
I am to follow when?
He will return in a fortnight, God willing.
A fortnight, Mary says. Alone with the person?
Before then, madam, you are to go to another palace. He's chosen the Moor, in Hertfordshire, which you know is very comfortable.
Being the Cardinal's house, Mary says, it would be lavish.
My own daughters, he thinks, would never have spoken so. Princess, he says, will you, of your charity, cease to speak ill of a man who never did you harm? Mary blushes from neckline to hairline.
I did not mean to fail in charity.
The late Cardinal is your godfather. You owe him your prayers. Her eyes flicker towards him. She looks cowed.
I pray to shorten his term in purgatory.
Catherine interrupts her.
Send a box to Hertfordshire. Send a package. Do not seek to send me.
You shall have your whole court. The household is ready for 200.
I shall write to the king. You may carry the letter. My place is with him.
My advice, he says, take this gently, or he may... He indicates the princess. His hands join and drift apart. Separate you. The child is fighting down pain. Her mother is fighting down grief and anger and disgust and fear.
I expected this, she says, but I did not expect he would send a man like you to tell me.
He frowns. Does she think it would come better from Norfolk?
They say you had a trade as a blacksmith. Is that correct?
Now she will say, shoe a horse. It was my father's trade.
I begin to understand you, she nods. The blacksmith makes his own tools.
Half a mile of chalk walls, a mirror for the glare, bounce at him a white heat. In the shadow of a gateway, Gregory and Rafe are jostling and pushing, insulting each other with culinary insults he has taught them. Sir, you are a fat Fleming and spread butter on your bread. Sir, you are a Roman pauper. May your offspring eat snails. Master Risley is leaning in the sun and watching them with a lazy smile. Butterflies garland his head. Oh, it's you, he says. Risley looks gratified. You look fit to be painted, Master Risley. A doublet of azure, and a shaft of light precisely placed.
Sir, Catherine says.
She says our precedents are fake. Rafe.
Does she understand that you and Dr. Cranmer sat up all night over them?
Oh, wild times, Gregory says, seeing the dawning with Dr. Cranmer.
He throws an arm around Rafe's bony little shoulders and squeezes him. It is a liberation to be away from Catherine, from the girl flinching like a whipped bitch. Once I myself, with Giovannino, well, with some boys I knew. He stops. What is this? I don't tell stories about myself.
Please,
Risley says. Well, we had a statue made. A smirking little god with wings. And then we beat it with hammers and chains to make it antique. And we hired a muleteer and drove it to Rome and sold it to a cardinal. Such a hot day. when they were ushered into his presence. Hazy thunder in the distance, and white dust from building sites hanging in the air. I remember he had tears in his eyes when he paid us. To think that on these charming little feet and these sweet pinions the gaze of the Emperor Augustus may have rested. When the Portinari boys set off for Florence, they were staggering under the weight of their purses.
And you?
I took my cut, and stayed on to sell the mules. They head downhill through the inner courts, emerging into the sun. He shades his eyes, as if to see through the tangle of treetops that runs into the distance. I told the Queen, let Henry go in peace, or he might not let the Princess move with her up country. Risley says, surprised,
but it is decided. They are to be separated. Mary is to go to Richmond.
He did not know. He hopes his hesitation is not perceptible. Of course. But the Queen had not been told. And it was worth a try, yes? See how useful Master Risley is. See how he brings us intelligence from Secretary Gardiner. Rafe says, it is harsh to use the little girl against her mother. Harsh, yes. But the question is, have you picked your prince? Because that is what you do. You choose him, and you know what he is. And then, when you have chosen, you say yes to him. Yes, that is possible. Yes, that can be done. If you don't like Henry, you can go abroad and find another prince. But I tell you, if this were Italy, Catherine would be cold in her tomb.
But you swore, Gregory says, that you respected the Queen.
So I do. And I would respect her corpse.
You would not work her death, would you?
He halts. He takes his son's arm, turns him to look into his face. Retrace our steps through this conversation. Gregory pulls away. No, listen, Gregory. I said, you give way to the king's requests. You open the way to his desires. That is what a courtier does. Now understand this. It is impossible that Henry should require me or any other person to harm the Queen. What is he, a monster? Even now he has affection for her. How could he not? And he has a soul he hopes may be saved. He confesses every day to one or other of his chaplains. Do you think the Emperor does so much, or King Francis? Henry's heart, I assure you, is a heart full of feeling, and Henry's soul, I swear, is the most scrutinized soul in Christendom. Risley says,
Master Cromwell, he is your son, not an ambassador.
He lets Gregory go. Shall we get on the river? There might be a breeze. In the lower ward, six couples of hunting dogs stir and yelp in the cages on wheels, which are going to carry them across country. Tails waving, they're clambering over each other, twisting ears and nipping, their yaps and howls adding to the sense of near panic that has taken over the castle. It's more like the evacuation of a fort than the start of a summer progress. Sweating porters are heaving the king's furnishings onto carts. Two men with a studded chest have got wedged in a doorway. He thinks of himself on the road, a bruised child, loading wagons to get a lift. He wanders over. How did this happen, boys? He steadies one corner of the chest and backs them off into the shadows, adjusts the degree of rotation with a flip of his hand, a moment's fumbling and slipping, and they burst into the light, shouting, "Here she goes!" as if they'd thought of it themselves. Be packing for the Queen next, he says, for the Cardinal's palace at the moor. And they say, surprised, is that so, Master? And what if the Queen won't go? He says, then we will roll her up in a carpet and put her on your cart. He hands out coins. Ease up. It's too hot to work so hard. He saunters back to the boys. A man leads up horses ready for harnessing to the hounds' wagons. And as soon as they catch their scent, the dogs set up an excited barking, which can still be heard as they get on the water. The river is brown, torpid. On the Eton bank, A group of listless swans glides in and out of the weeds. The boat bobs beneath them. He says, "Is that not Cyan Madoc?"
"Never forget a fierce ear."
"Not when it's ugly."
"Have you seen yourself, Bach?"
The boatman has been eating an apple, core and all. Fastidious, he flicks the pips over the side.
"How's your dad?"
"Dead."
Cyan spits the stalk out.
"Any of these yours?"
"Me,"
Gregory says.
"That's mine."
Cyan nods to the opposite oar, a lump of a lad who reddens and looks away.
"Your dad used to shut up shop in this weather. Put the fire out and go fishing."
"Lashing the water with his rod," he says, "and punching the lights out of the fish. Jump in and drag them gasping out of the green deep. Fingers through the gills."
"What are you looking at, you scaly horse, son? You looking at me?" "He not been want to sit and enjoy the sunshine," Madoc explains. "I could tell you stories about Walter Cromwell."
Master Risley's face is a study. He does not understand how much you can learn from boatmen. Their argo blasphemous and rapid. At 12, he spoke it fluently, his mother tongue, and now it flows back into his mouth, something natural, something dirty. There are tags of Greek he has mastered, which he exchanges with Thomas Cranmer, with Call Me Risley. Early language, unblighted like tender fruit. But never does a Greek scholar pin back your ears as Cyan does now, with Putney's opinion of the fucking Bullens. Henry goes to it with the mother. Good luck to him. He goes to it with the sister. What's a king for? But it's got to stop somewhere. We're not beasts of the field. Cyan calls Anne an eel. He calls her a slippery dipper from the slime. And he remembers what the cardinal had called her. My serpentine enemy. Cyan says, she goes to it with her brother. He says, what, her brother George?
Any brother she's got. Those can't keep it in the family. They do filthy French tricks like...
Can you keep your voice down? He looks around, as if spies might be swimming by the boat.
And that's how she trusts herself she don't give in to Henry. Because if she lets him do it, and she gets a boy, he's thanks very much. Now clear off, girl. So she's, oh, your highness, I never could allow, because she knows that very night her brother's inside her, licking her up to the lungs. And then he's, excuse me, sister, what shall I do with this big package? She says, oh, don't distress yourself, my lord brother. Shove it up the back entry. It'll come to no harm there.
Thanks, he says. I had no idea how they were managing. The boys have got about one word in three. Cyan gets a tip. It's worth anything to be reacquainted with the Putney imagination. He will cherish Sion's simper, very unlike the real Anne. Later, at home, Gregory says,
ought people to speak like that and be paid for it?
He was speaking his mind.
He shrugs. So, if you want to know people's minds...
Call Me Risley is frightened of you. He says... When you were coming from Chelsea with Master Secretary, you threatened to throw him out of his own barge and drown him.
That is not precisely his memory of the conversation.
And does Cormie think I would do it?
Yes. He thinks you would do anything.
At New Year, he had given Anne a present of silver forks with handles of rock crystal. He hopes she will use them to eat with, not to stick in people.
From Venice.
She is pleased. She holds them up so the handles catch and splinter the light. He has brought another present for her to pass on. It is wrapped in a piece of sky-blue silk. It's for the little girl who always cries. Anne's mouth opens a little.
Don't you know?
Her eyes brim with black glee.
Come, so I can tell you in your ear.
Her cheek brushes his. Her skin is faintly perfumed, amber, rose.
Sir John Seymour? Dear Sir John? Old Sir John, as people call him.
Sir John is not, perhaps, more than a dozen years older than himself. But amiability can be ageing. With his sons Edward and Tom, now the young men about court, he does give the impression of having eased into retirement.
Now we understand why we never see him, Anne murmurs. Now we know what he does down in the country.
Hunting, I thought.
Yes, and he has netted Catherine Philol, Edward's wife. They were taken in the act, but I cannot find out where, whether in her bed, or his, or in a meadow, a hayloft. Yes, cold to be sure, but they were keeping each other warm. And now Sir John has confessed it all, man to man, telling his son to his face that he's had her every week since the wedding. So that's about 2 years and, say, 6 months, so...
You could round it off to 120 times, assuming they abstain at the major feasts.
Adulterers don't stop for Lent.
Oh, and I thought they did.
She's had two babies, so allow respite for her lying in. And they are boys, you know. So Edward is...
He imagines how Edward is. That pure hawk's profile.
He is cutting them out of the family. They are to be bastards. She, Catherine Philol, she's to be put in a convent. I think he should put her in a cage. He is asking for an annulment. As for dear Sir John, I think we will not see him at court soon.
Why are we whispering? I must be the last person in London to hear.
The king hasn't heard, and you know how proper he is. So if someone is to come to him joking about it, let it not be me or you.
And the daughter? Jane, is it? Anne sniggers.
Pasty face. Gone down to Wiltshire. Her best move will be to follow the sister-in-law into a nunnery. Her sister Lizzie married well. But no one wants milksop, and now no one will.
Her eyes fall on his present. She says, suddenly anxious, jealous.
What is it?
Only a book of needlework patterns.
As long as it is nothing to tax her wits. Why would you send her a present?
I feel sorry for her. More now, of course.
Oh, you don't like her, do you?
The correct answer is no, my Lady Anne, I only like you.
Because, is it proper for you to send her a present?
It is not, as if it is tales out of Boccaccio. She laughs.
They could tell Boccaccio a tale, those sinners at Wolf Hall.
Thomas Hitton, a priest, was burned just as February went out, taken up by Fisher, Bishop of Rochester, as a smuggler of Tyndale scriptures. Soon afterwards, rising from the bishop's frugal table, a dozen guests had collapsed, vomiting, rigid with pain, and been taken pale and almost pulseless to their beds and the ministrations of the doctors. Dr. Butt said the broth had done it. From testimony of the waiting boys, it was the only dish they had tasted in common. There are poisons nature herself brews, and he, before putting the bishop's cook to the torture, would have visited the kitchens and passed the skimmer over the stockpot. But no one else doubts there has been a crime. Presently the cook admits to adding to the broth a white powder which someone gave him. Who? Just the man. A stranger who had said it would be a good joke to give Fisher and his guests a purge. The king is beside himself, rage and fear. He blames heretics. Dr. Butts, shaking his head, pulling his lower lip, says that poison is what Henry fears worse than hell itself. Would you put poison in a bishop's dinner because a stranger told you it would be a laugh? The cook won't say more, or perhaps he has reached the stage beyond saying. The interrogation has been mismanaged then, he says to Butts. I wonder why. The doctor, a man who loves the gospel, laughs sourly and says, If they wanted the man to talk, they should have called in Thomas More. The word is that the Lord Chancellor has become a master in the twin arts of stretching and compressing the servants of God. When heretics are taken, he stands by the tower while the torture is applied. It is reported that in his gatehouse at Chelsea, he keeps suspects in the stocks while he preaches at them and harries them. The name of your printer, the name of the master of the ship that brought these books into England. They say he uses the whip, the manacles, and the torment frame they call Skevington's daughter. It is a portable device into which a man is folded, knees to chest, with a hoop of iron across his back. By means of a screw, the hoop is tightened until his ribs crack.